Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network. Are you worried about democracy? I have to confess, I am a bit worried about democracy. That's why I listen to a wonderful podcast called Democracy Works. It's run by the fabulous people at the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State University. The podcast aims to rise above partisan politics and the daily news grind to take a broader look at issues impacting democracy. These are things we cannot ignore. You can go to www.democracyworkspodcast.com and subscribe in all kinds of ways, or you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and many other places. We really love this podcast at the NBN, and so much so that we are going to provide you with a little taste of what you can get at Democracy Works. I hope you enjoy the following episode.
By obliterating facticity, by obliterating our access to a shared world of facts and events, by delegitimating, you know, expert-staffed agencies that create basic data and knowledge, what it really does is incapacitate our ability to disagree, to argue, to decide, and to adopt effective policies, whether they're liberal or conservative. We really do want to call on people to use their common sense in responding to things that seem too fabulous to be true. They just very well might be untrue.
From the McCourtney Institute for Democracy on the campus of Penn State University, I'm Michael Berkman.
And I'm Chris Beam.
And I'm Jenna Spinelli. And welcome to the fourth season of Democracy Works. New season, guys. Here we are. After our summer break.
Doesn't feel like it. It's like 90 degrees outside.
And it doesn't feel like much of a break. But, you know, we owe it to our listeners to come back and give, and given the condition of democracy around the world, we should keep going. So
democracy hasn't gotten much better this summer.
Doesn't seem to have. Yeah. No. Mm-mm.
Yeah, so today on the show, we're going to start off by talking about conspiracy theories and what our guests argue is a new form of conspiracism.
It's conspiracy without the theory.
Yes, right? Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And joining us to help unpack that are Russell Muirhead and Nancy Rosenblum, who are the authors of a new book called A Lot of People Are Saying, The New Conspiracism and the Assault on Democracy. Russell is the Robert Clements Professor of Democracy and Politics at Dartmouth College, and Nancy is a Senator Joseph Clark Research Professor of Ethics and Politics and Government at Harvard. So two very well-regarded experts in this field, and we are very fortunate to have them on the show for this conversation.
Yeah, it's a terrific book.
And a great title.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The conspiracy theories have deep roots in American politics.
It's really interesting. They actually mentioned that it goes all the way back to the Revolution, that there was a kind of conspiracy dimension to that, which I really hadn't thought of, but it makes sense to me.
And let's face it, I mean, and they speak to this, but there's, it's not distrust of government, distrust of authority is also a part of American identity and really a kind of legitimate part.
We have a constitution designed to fragment power.
Exactly. Yep. And so it is not that far from distrust to conspiracy, and trying to figure out where you go from legitimate to illegitimate is part of the problem that they set out in the book.
What I think that these authors are identifying, and which the president plays a big role in, is this idea that conspiracy theories these days seem not to be an effort to explain something that has actually happened, but rather are just kind of created out of whole cloth. So, you know, for example, there have been conspiracy theories still today in American politics about who shot President Kennedy.
Right.
But President Kennedy was shot. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. we know that that event happened, and it's kind of understandable that people would think, oh, you know, one guy with a rifle couldn't do this, or there has to be more to it. Or the moon landing. We know there was something we saw on TV. Was it faked?
Right.
Or was it real?
Or the folks, you know, were these guys from Saudi Arabia single-handedly able to bring down the World
right.
Trade Center?
Right, the 9/11 truthers. Right. Mm-hmm. But we know that the Trade Towers right. came down, mm-hmm. and we know that the Pentagon was attacked. But now, you know, if you look at something like Pizzagate, which is an example they use in mm-hmm. the book, here's a conspiracy, this idea that there was a child prostitution ring being run out of a pizza parlor in Washington.
And this was John Podesta and Hillary Clinton.
Podesta and Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, because they had nothing better to do.
I mean, this is created out of whole cloth. There was no there.
Right.
It wasn't like there was an arrest. It wasn't like there was a witness. It wasn't like there was a child.
And they just made it up. And it's really, you know, we have to just acknowledge this is just how crazy this idea is.
You know, it's interesting that this book was written by these two authors, because when you look at their previous work, most of it had to do with political parties
right.
in America.
Mm-hmm.
They're party scholars,
right.
political theorists, but party scholars.
Mm-hmm.
And part of their motivation in writing this book has to do with their concern about how the idea of a loyal opposition party is being destroyed through these sorts of conspiracies, and that, you know, that the other side are criminals, the other side are whatever.
They have no legitimacy, not just as partisans, but as human beings.
Well, maybe we ought to hear from them.
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah.
This is Jenna Spinelli here today with Nancy Rosenblum and Russell Muirhead. Nancy and Russ, thanks for joining us today on Democracy Works.
Delighted to be here.
So you guys are the authors of a new book that's all about conspiracies and conspiracism. You know, the conspiracy theories have been around as long as the U.S. itself, and you talk about that a little bit in the book, but you also argue that we are now in a new era of conspiracism, and I thought that might be a good place to start. What is this new era as you see it, and how is it different from what we've seen in the past?
Well, in the past, we've had conspiracy theory. That is an explanation that works the way any explanation works, which is in terms of evidence and dots and patterns that often try to make the unbelievable believable and the inconceivable conceivable. What we have now is conspiracy without the theory. That is, the two things have become decoupled. And we have claims of a conspiracy that come without the dots, without the patterns, without the evidence, without the argument.
When did you begin to see this pattern emerge?
Well, Nancy and I are scholars of parties and partisanship, and you know, parties were thought of as conspiracies before the age of sort of the idea of a legitimate opposition took hold. That's how parties were conceived. That's really what they were. So as scholars of parties, we began to take an interest in conspiracism and conspiratorial thinking. And among the things we notice, aside from its abundance and aside from the fact that it's moved from the periphery to the center of at least American politics, we also began to notice that that today's conspiracism involves sort of bare assertion, maybe like a one-word accusation like rigged, instead of an effort to carefully explain the world as it is. It's more of an effort to impose a kind of unreality, an idiosyncratic understanding of the world on others, rather than to describe the world as it is. And instead of being an act of empowerment, which is what conspiracy theory tries to do, empower people by describing the way the world is, it's an act of power. It's an effort to impose one person or one side's distorted view of things on everyone.
Yeah, and I think we can think about, and you know, maybe just to draw some examples here to give people a more concrete idea of what we're talking about. You know, I think about, and I think you guys write about in your book too, the, for example, the 9/11 truther movements versus something like Pizzagate. Is that a fair way of kind of drawing a distinction between sort of the former model of conspiracy thinking and what we're seeing now? And can you talk about what the difference is between those two models?
That's exactly right, Jenna. 9/11 is an example of classic conspiracy theory. And there are accounts that come from the left and the right about what really happened. It was really the Jews, or it was really an inside job. And they collect all kinds of technical evidence to try to make that claim about how the conspiracy happened and who its agents were. In contrast, we do have this conspiracy without the theory. And an example that I'll give that really excited me into wanting this project came on the second day of Trump's presidency after the inauguration, when he claimed that it was the biggest inaugural crowd ever. And when the National Park Service produced, you probably remember this, produced photos that showed the crowd to be much less large than he had claimed, he said that the National Park Service had doctored the photographs. He had no evidence. He didn't have an argument. It was just a sheer assertion that this, that there had been a conspiracy to show or to make it appear as if his inauguration was less spectacular than President Obama's. And it was at that point that I think we both began to realize that one of the real consequences of this conspiracy without the theory, and you probably experienced this, Jenna, was a radical disorientation, a radical disorientation. It was a claim, Russ talked about imposition of power. It was a claim about that he owned reality, that the conspiracists owned reality. And we were left thinking, well, who does own reality? And it creates, I think, a polarization between people claiming to own their reality and the another based on evidence and argument. That's a polarization that's deeper even than partisan polarization.
Right. And the goal, if I understand it correctly, is not necessarily to get people to believe every word of these new conspiracy theories, but it's more so just to like sow confusion and general distrust of the institutions and the media and the people who are providing information.
Yeah, I think that is. You know, often the goal, it's certainly not to equip us to really understand our world so that we can navigate our way, you know, control, you might say, our fate more successfully. You know, that classic conspiracism, it starts with something in the world that many people have a hard time understanding. The example you brought up, 9/11 truthers, I mean, they start with the fact that it's really hard to explain how 19 people in Afghanistan created this world historical event, culminating an invasion by the United States of Iraq. Those, you know, are not easy events to explain. The cause seems really small compared to the effect. Pizzagate, the other example you mentioned, I mean, what is that trying to explain? Or the park size controversy. It's not as though there are thousands or tens of thousands or millions of people who are confused about the size of the crowd at the inauguration. It doesn't take a world that's hard to explain and make it more understandable. It takes a world that's shared, that's transparent, and makes it one that, as Nancy said, is very disorienting and very confusing. And ultimately is not only disorienting, it's very disempowering.
Sure. So do you guys have a sense of what the scale is here? I mean, how many people or what proportion of the U.S. population tends to support this conspiratorial type of thinking or tends to find these claims as valid or, you know, tends to get behind some of these conspiracy theories?
We haven't done a sociological study of these things. What we know from people who have is that other kinds of conspiracism have very large followers. you know, the hoaxes that are out there, or the flat earthers, and so on and so forth. Our sense here is that the people who are taken up by these political conspiracist claims are probably not a very large number. But what's interesting about it is that they think, and they don't necessarily have to believe every element of the claim. The phrase that we use that I think is helpful is that they find these claims true enough. They're true enough, even if they're not followed by supported by evidence. They're true enough for them, and that means that subscription to these claims really is more a form of political participation than the kind of belief in the accuracy of the claims that conspiracy theory tries to generate.
And by lowering the bar, by even just obliterating the question of what do I really believe, what do I have evidence for believing, and replacing it with a question that's more connected to like political identity, what am I willing to sort of say, it's creating a new kind of schism in the political world, not just a difference between sort of liberals and conservatives, the polarization that we've become very accustomed to. It's creating a kind of like epistemic polarization where we no longer share a world of facts and events.
That explains the title of our book. A lot of people are saying that the validation of these claims has nothing to do with argument or evidence or dots or patterns. It has to do with the number of followers. And that's, I think that explains part of the importance of social media for this kind of conspiracism. I mean, it's obvious that it increases the scope of it and the speed of the spread of these things and so on. But these tweets and Facebook likes and so on actually allow you to measure that a lot of people are saying this.
Right.
It gives you a kind of plausible measure of something that's completely implausible.
Russ, you mentioned just a minute ago the idea of epistemic polarization. Can you just explain what that is for folks who might not be familiar with that term?
Epistemic polarization bears on whether we think something really happened or didn't really happen. You know, it gets at the basic factual question of how many people were there on the Washington Mall on that particular day of the inauguration. And once we can't even agree on the most elemental and brute facticity, the most sort of elemental aspects of our shared reality, it starts to become really hard, not just to compromise, it becomes really hard even to disagree intelligibly with each other. And another aspect of the new conspiracism that really interests Nancy and me is the way that it increasingly focuses on knowledge-producing institutions, like almost apolitical agencies of the government that are staffed by technical experts and are charged with illuminating elemental facts, elemental data, and publicizing data, maybe about the climate, maybe, as Nancy said, maybe about the unemployment rate. And increasingly, the accusations say that the economists at the Bureau of Labor Statistics or the climate scientists in the National Weather, whatever agency, are conspiring to generate fraudulent pseudo data. And what this does is it delegitimates huge swaths of government. In fact, the least political, least ideological aspects of government. And that, you know, if it succeeds at sort of delegitimating these knowledge producing institutions, it's going to have, I think, we fear that it's going to have a very corrosive effect.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Sure. And I think to the point about creating confusion, all these things tend to just, it allows existing power structures to stay in place. In the case of climate change, it kind of kicks the can down the road and it makes it much harder to take action on some of these larger scale issues.
Let me just explain, if I can, very, very briefly, the difference between sowing confusion, which it certainly does, you're right, and causing distrust of agencies and people who make claims, which it certainly does, and what we claim, which is that it delegitimizes institutions. Because delegitimation goes beyond both of those things. It says that this agency, this political party, whatever, has lost all meaning, value, and authority, that it doesn't deserve compliance, right? And delegitimation really is the complete obliteration of the moral or political authority of a group or an institution. And, we don't know very much. We know quite a bit about how in growing democracies you legitimate government agencies and institutions and parties. We don't have much experience with this kind of delegitimation of an established democratic system, and we certainly don't know how to re-legitimate it.
It's not as if the people seeking to delegitimize these institutions are offering up something in its place, right? It is just about the sheer kind of taking away of authority and things like that. Is that right?
That's such a, I think such an astute observation, Jenna. We don't see, kind of a worked out kind of theory or comprehensive agenda behind the new conspiracism. Its impulse is very destructive, almost essentially destructive.
That's why, we say, I think that the new conspiracism is potent, but at the same time, it's politically sterile. The phrase we've adopted is that it's D all the way down, that it's destabilizing, degrading, deconstructing, delegitimating, without any real countervailing constructive impulse.
Okay, so, I think could take a very pessimistic view of this, as we are sometimes want to do on this podcast, and think that, things are already kind of past a tipping point or past a line of demarcation, that the Trump administration has already done so much to advance these delegitimation claims and created an environment where they can be successful and thrive and all of these things. So, given that environment, do you think that there's still an opportunity for things to go in a different direction?
One of the things that I think, that Nancy and I think is really crucial is that, people who really care about politics, let's say conservatives who really have an agenda, that they understand that this force, the new conspiracism, which might seem to help their cause in the first act, ends up destroying it in the conclusion. Let me give you an example. What the new conspiracism often does is it just kind of remakes the political world so as to obliterate all bad facts, all facts that are that cause ambiguity or embarrassment, say, to your own cause. So let's say, Hillary Clinton's running against Donald Trump for the presidency, and you think on balance, all things considered, Trump is the better person to vote for. What Pizzagate does is it takes that considered decision and exaggerates it by showing Hillary Clinton to be the repository of all evil. She is torturing, trafficking in children, torturing children. She's worse than a Nazi. She's not just the less preferable candidate, all things considered. She's evil. And it removes all ambiguity and increases certainty. So that might seem something like Pizzagate to assist the conservative cause in the first act. It might seem like this is helping the effort to, say, elect a Republican. But by obliterating facticity, by obliterating our access to a shared world of facts and events, by delegitimating, expert-staffed agencies that create basic data and knowledge, what it really does is incapacitate our ability to disagree, to argue, to decide, and to adopt effective policies, whether they're liberal or conservative. And it undermines even, our effort to have any kind of government, a conservative government, a liberal government, a moderate government. And that's how it destroys the cause in the end. So Nancy and I are, we're hopeful that, if we can sort of reveal how universally destructive this is, that people will understand that it's not friendly to any cause, and that partisan officials will be more courageous in standing up to it.
So I want to talk about the media for a second here. So what role do they play in helping to, or maybe not helping to, spread some of the new conspiracism? I think on the one hand, you could say that maybe by bringing some of these things to light, they're helping people, understand what's going on and helping try to provide a glimpse into how other people think. But I think also you could say that they, but the more that these stories get reported, the more traction they get and the more likely they are to spread. So what should the media's approach be in terms of covering these theories?
When we refer now, of course, to the media, we're no longer referring to just those enterprises with, professional gatekeepers, producers, and editors who decide what's worthy of being disseminated to millions and millions of people. The new media, including social media, allows anybody to say anything to everyone in the whole world for free. And it's that power, it's that you might call it a kind of Gutenberg effect, that is facilitating the new conspiracism. So it's really not the traditional media. It's not BBC or the New York Times or what's called the mainstream media, which is just the media with gatekeepers, that's in any way responsible for this. We think that there's a few little things that are worth reminding responsible reporters and editors and producers about. One is just that this is not theory, that this new conspiracism shouldn't even be given the kind of authority that the word theory conveys. We should refer to this as invention and concoction, which is what it is. Secondly, I guess we want to inspire confidence in those sections of the media that still have gatekeepers, that the common sense of citizens, of readers, of viewers might in the end prevail. And that the kind of evidentiary approach to what gets disseminated, what gets broadcast, what gets printed, in the end, might win out in spite of all that there is to be discouraged about.
Sure. And on the social media point, I think some of these conversations are for sure happening behind closed Facebook groups and on, message boards and other outlets where they're kind of closed off in and of themselves. But there are other places I think we can all probably conjure, seeing comments on Facebook or threads on Twitter where some of these, the new conspiracism is kind of being debated. And so for what are some good strategies there? Or is it even worth trying to engage with people who are out there spreading these messages?
Well, this is a hard question. I think that there have been attempts to try to take some sort of people like Alex Jones, who's not just a conspiracist and often the sort of entrepreneur who authors some of these things, but also, is engaged in defamation and threatening, if indirectly, the lives of people and so on and so forth. So there has been some attempt to censor this. And this, of course, is countered with the view that this is a conspiracy against the right. I don't know that social media can be used to really counter all of this. As I say, I think that what's important about social media for this kind of conspiracism is just the numbers of people who like and retweet and tweet and so on and so forth, because it's what gives, it's a form of political participation that gives them gratification, and it gives validation to these crazy claims. I would say that there are some studies that show that it's not just social media, that we shouldn't put all of our emphasis on it in trying to explain what happens. That Fox News, for example, has enormous audiences, and enormous audiences of people who aren't necessarily paranoid and conspiracists or even going along with this stuff. And insofar as this is the news they get, or insofar as this is the discussion or the news that goes on in local, you know, channels, where most people still get their news through these things, it's dangerous and unstoppable, so long as these are privately owned corporations that find that you know, their profits go up when they do this.
And let's differentiate between two populations: one that really gives itself over to a kind of conspiracist concoction, the population that includes the person, for instance, who went to the pizzeria in Washington with an assault rifle that he fired to self-investigate the Pizzagate allegations. So there's that population that really seems to believe it. But then there's a larger population that is just disoriented, as Nancy says, and that is at risk, not so much of believing it, but of not knowing what to believe. And that's the population that we have to fight for. You know, evidence, I think, increasingly suggests that things like fact-checking and corrections does work and can work at disempowering misinformation in the minds of readers and viewers. And so I think, you know, standing up for common sense, appealing to common sense, insisting on evidence, calling something a lie that is a lie, and you know, not using a word like theory for something that is no kind of theory, might make a big difference with that much larger audience that's at risk of disorientation, not necessarily of belief.
Can you just expand a little bit more on how you perceive common sense or how it applies in this context?
Well, we're not using it in some deep philosophical way, because there are debates about common sense in philosophy and epistemology. I think, you know, we took our notion of common sense from Tom Paine's great pamphlet, Common Sense, right, in which he argued that people have certain kinds of common experiences and a common moral horizon, and that if they can stand by this experience of themselves, if they can have a kind of confidence in their experience and in what they know and in the moral horizon that they share, then they can resist people who claim to own a different reality.
And, you know, we might say, looking back to the dawn of democracy and Thomas Paine and his essay, is that, you know, modern democracy is founded on this conviction that you might say, if you don't want to use the word common sense, the epistemic capacities of ordinary citizens are sufficient for them to understand the world in a way that equips them to make good decisions. We believe that this basic capacity is, we share the faith that it's widely distributed across the entire population, and that it can prevail. And so we really do want to call on people to use their common sense in responding to things that seem too fabulous to be true. They just very well might be untrue.
Well, I think that is probably as optimistic of a note as we're going to get here to end this. But no, I think your book and indeed a lot of what we're trying to do on this podcast are just that, to empower people to use their common sense and, you know, put that to work to do the hard work of democracy. Thank you both for your contribution to this work and for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you, Jen. This was terrific.
Yeah, thank you very much, Jen.
All right, so this is Chris and Michael. We're back. Really impressive interview. A lot to chew on there. Michael, the point that I really wanted to stress with them, and that I thought they really hit out of the park, was this idea of a democratic common sense.
Well, also the idea that the, you know, democracy is founded on the idea that ordinary citizens have the capacity to understand things and make decisions.
The other part is that there is this presumption of a common resource, both factual and moral, that allows us, that is necessary for us to have politics at all.
Really speaks to the sort of dangers of this very siloed, fragmented kind of media environment we're in, where one side seems to listen to one set of media, pay attention to one set of media, and the other another.
Right. And not to mention, you know, the number of people who have just kind of made this their industry. Alex Jones is very wealthy. You know, let's not deny this, despite the fact that he is a cancer on the civic culture. But
Political leaders ought to be saying that.
They ought to.
It doesn't really mean anything for us to say.
It's easy, right? But no, you're right. And to disown it, and it doesn't matter whose mouth it comes out of. Any time it comes out of somebody's mouth.
No, it does matter. It matters. I think they're very clear that it matters, because they have this idea of what they call enacting democracy, or democracy as pedagogy. And their argument there, as I understood it, is that public officials of all types, judges, congresspeople, bureaucrats, have a responsibility these days to explain in some detail how it is that they're making decisions. In other words, to be talking about the entire process of legislating, prosecuting, regulating, investigating, whatever it is they're doing, walking through that there are fair processes here, that there are
grounded in law,
right? That they have value,
right?
That there's a reason we do this. That there needs to be a kind of instruction. You know, it's really striking. One thing I've been thinking of, and they talk about this a bit in their book. I've thought about it a lot at other times too. Has to do with these two FBI officials that were, fired essentially in the midst of the Mueller investigation, and the idea that these two people could have come up with this whole scheme by themselves. And at least one of them in his testimony, and they point to this example, made the point, you know, bureaucracies are set up as hierarchies. There are all these people above me. I mean, that's how we set up for democratic accountability.
Right.
I don't have the ability
to
do this by myself. I'm overseen at multiple steps, and those people are overseen, and those people are overseen. Mm-hmm. And that this is a responsibility that officials have to have in this day and age.
So I think there's this interesting combination of, both despairing about the condition of a democracy right now, and also just trying to reclaim the high ground that democracy, that's part of democracy, right? So on the one hand, you have this kind of, you know, this conspiracism is undermining the commonality that the democracy depends on. But at the same time, they're saying, but there's nothing special. There's nothing, you know, particularly, there's no requirement to you to be part of this. If you just own your standing as a regular person and reflect responsibly on your own experiences, then you are part of this common sense that democracy requires.
Let's actually end on I think you bring up a really important issue there that speaks to something larger than the conspiracism. You know, so they speak in the book about the crisis of democracy being this sort of disorientation that people know, but also the delegitimation of the opposition party, for example, and other institutions. And this is something, we've talked about this before, we are just seeing one institution in American political life after another being absolutely decimated and turned into a sort of partisan target.
These people are out to, they have a partisan agenda, and that's their sole agenda.
It started during the campaign when the president was saying that a Hispanic judge could not rule on the case having to do with Trump University, because, of course, he's Hispanic. It has to do with the idea that the FBI can't be trusted. The courts have been constantly attacked.
These are my judges.
And do you have any confidence?
Are they Obama judges?
Do you have, that idea, do you have any confidence in the census anymore?
Right. No, I think that's right.
And I think one thing we're going to realize when this administration is done is how much the federal bureaucracy has both been decimated and hollowed out and has just lost any kind of standing in American life.
I'm just as pessimistic about this as you are.
A little bit more pessimistic now than I've been in a very long time.
Yeah, it is. It's not great out there. But I like the fact that they speak directly to the moral argument for democracy.
Yes.
And the fact that we still see those arguments manifested.
Yeah.
And that they're worth not just reclaiming, but they're worth insisting upon.
Yeah. I think we should mention as well that this is a beautiful book to read.
It is.
It is just wonderfully written. It is fairly short. It's not dense at all. I was really captivated by it.
No, these are very well-respected scholars, and this is a genuine contribution to our public debate. Right,
yeah,
now.
Really quite important work.
For the McCourtney Institute for Democracy, I'm Chris Beam.
I'm Michael Berkman.
Thanks for listening.
This has been Democracy Works.